Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect Podcast with me, Ellen Halliday. At the end of February, the government released updated figures about the number of people experiencing homelessness and the number of households in temporary accommodation in England. The picture, I think it's fair to say, is not positive. Some 3,898 people were sleeping rough across England. That's an increase of 27% on the previous year. The number of people sleeping rough is now 61% higher than a decade ago and 120% higher than when data was first collected in 2010. The government had a target to end rough sleeping by the end of 2024, but the housing charity Crisis, whose analysis I looked at, has commented, again, I think fairly, that this increase means it's unlikely to meet that target. For the latest issue of Prospect, Samira Shackle looked into the growing body of evidence which suggests that direct cash transfers, i.e. giving people who are at risk of homelessness money, could be a solution to the problem. To talk about all of this, we're joined by Samira and by Jonathan Tan, who is co-founder of Greater Change, a non-profit that helps tackle homelessness through just such measures. Samira and Jonathan, it's lovely to have you. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Jonathan, first of all, I wanted to ask you, what was your reaction to these updated figures on homelessness that were released by the government just a few weeks ago?
Well, it's a mix of horror, I guess, in a way, but also not unexpected, right? Because the cost of living crisis really started, what would we say now, about a year and a half, 2 years ago? And we knew, and there was an Office for National Statistics stat that really sort of keeps me up at night, which is that, you know, 42% of UK households have fewer than 3 months savings in their bank accounts, which is, I think, really, really scary. And I think when you know that, you put it in context of rising economic challenges for people in the UK, I think it's sadly unsurprising, right? And we know that far more radical measures are needed really to address the crisis as it is today. And that's the, I think, slightly depressing thing that we have to start on, which is that this is a fight that we're losing. You know, this is something that day to day, you know, we're trying to do a lot in our very small team with our limited capacity, but fundamentally, you know, we're not at the moment moving the needle in the right direction.
Greater Change is a non-profit that you co-founded a few years ago now, and the idea is that you give people cash directly and kind of the freedom to do with it what they want. I mean, can you tell us about why you wanted to set that up and what the kind of motivation was for that approach?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one quick correction there, I'll just say up front, is that we don't give cash directly. I can talk about why as well. So the motivation for setting up Greater Change really came about when my co-founder Alex and myself were volunteering at a local charity at the time called Aspire in Oxford. They're a fantastic charity. Lots of their support workers have lived experience of homelessness. And as you do when you first get into the sector, you ask some pretty naive questions about homelessness. So you say, okay, the UK is the sixth wealthiest country in the world. Why does homelessness exist to the extent that it does? And then I think one of the really sort of stereotype breaking things was when you first get into the specifics of the problem, the stats, you realize that whilst rough sleeping is a really acute and dangerous form of homelessness, actually, it makes up just a very small proportion of the total number of people experiencing homelessness in the UK. right? Most people are stuck in temporary accommodation, you know, in your rundown bed and breakfast that local authorities are paying through the nose for. I'm sure everyone has seen sort of the latest stats about how, you know, estimates are 1 in 5 local authorities are, you know, at risk of going bust, essentially. And one of the major drivers of that is how much money they're spending on temporary accommodation. So not to go too far into that rabbit hole, but the whole idea was that, you know, we were starting to work in the sector. We saw a lot of evidence coming out of international NGOs like GiveDirectly that showed that, you know, cash transfers were a really great way to lift people out of poverty. And we kind of said, well, there's no reason to think it wouldn't work just as well here. And when you talked to support workers on the front lines, when you talked to clients and you asked them why they were stuck in temporary accommodation, you know, as the name suggests, it's meant to be a short temporary stepping stone. It almost never is. So why was that the case, right? Why were they stuck in place? And the answers that we got back were really varied, as you can imagine, on a sort of case-by-case basis. Different people have different aspirations, different strengths. But the underlying commonality was that they faced some kind of barrier that was fundamentally financial in nature, right? That, you know, it could be rent deposit and first month's rent. It could be employment support, anything really under the sun. And so we thought, well, you know, if you put two and two together and you look at sort of the evidence that was coming out of the international space, you look at the testimony that we were getting from people who were really experts by experience, then, you know, it seemed pretty obvious that this was the way to go. And then as I said, we had to adapt the model, bringing it to the UK. We couldn't quite figure out direct cash transfers because we were really worried that this was going to affect people's benefit caps. And so, you know, if you transfer money directly into their bank accounts, we're kind of worried that that would lead to some sanctions further down the line. And so the idea was that we would deliver it through their support workers. So they still get full say over how they want to spend the money, but they access it through support workers. And in effect, then that sort of bypasses that fear. And as I said, it really kept me up at night quite a lot because the average size of our intervention is about £800. And, you know, if you just get 1 to 2 months of benefit sanctions, that wipes out the effect of what we're trying to do.
Samira, for the report that you wrote for Prospect, you spoke to Jonathan and you spoke to some of the people who Greater Change has also helped along the way. What was it about Greater Change's approach that you thought was interesting and kind of worth digging into?
I think that it's the simplicity of the approach, actually, and also how small the amount of money is sometimes that's needed. Because, you know, as Jonathan just said, £800, that's not a huge amount of money. If you're thinking about the average cost of someone who is in temporary accommodation, the kind of myriad ways in which someone who is homeless has kind of catastrophic effects on their mental and physical health and all the, you know, all the different ways in which that costs money, as well as obviously extreme distress to the person, but just on the pure financial aspect of it, it's a really small amount of money to save a huge amount of money for the government. So it's the kind of logic, I think, that was one of the things that really interested me. And when you dig into it, yeah, like £800 to clear rent arrears and that stops someone going into temporary accommodation, that saves, you know, untold emotional distress, as well as literally tens of thousands of pounds. And I think that's what I found so interesting, because of course, as Jonathan says, when we think about homelessness, we're often thinking about the most visible and vulnerable population, which is rough sleepers, but actually the vast majority are hidden homeless. And, you know, the kind of untold extra numbers of people who are at risk of slipping into that situation. And if there is this quite simple fix for at least some of those people, and probably quite a big proportion, it's quite remarkable that it's not being talked about more. And I think part of the reason for that is something which I explored in the article, is just how much that runs counter to the whole direction of public policy and discourse over the last few decades in particular. I think this idea that, you know, of scroungers, of people trying to get something from the state, of really kind of hacking back and back on an already quite fragile social safety net. And so it's kind of the opposite approach, but it's so simple, and the logic and the numbers really speak for themselves, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, that section of your piece where you talk about sort of the narrative of scroungers or sort of Cameron era Strivers and Skivers. And this, I mean, homelessness feels like an almost intractable problem. It seems like it's, you know, always present. This feels like a real fix, but there's this layer of prejudice that you unpick a bit. I mean, why do you think that developed? Where do you trace its origins to, Samira?
Big question. I think it goes right back. I mean, you see, I think something I talked about in the piece was that, you know, since Margaret Thatcher in the 70s talked about poverty as a personality defect caused by people who don't know how to budget, there was a 92 Conservative Party conference speech where Peter Lilly talked about the something for nothing society. And I think that's really been baked in. And you see that even in the Blair and Brown government, where they did actually introduce a lot of measures to ease poverty, particularly child poverty and amongst pensioners. They did a lot of work there, but the language was very much around, you know, a hand up, not handouts. And it's almost like the sort of framework in which you can have those discussions, even if you are trying to take positive action, it all has to be framed with, you know, we're not going to help too much, or we're not going to just give out, you know, not just going to give cash handouts. I think it's really interesting what you said there about this idea that homelessness is this intractable problem, because, you know, you asked what interested me in Greater Change's work. Something stayed in my mind from a piece I did for another magazine a few years ago in the pandemic, which was about homeless people, rough sleepers being housed in hotels in the pandemic to reduce the COVID risk. And that was kind of extraordinary because it showed that you actually can end rough sleeping. I mean, they decided to do it because of the COVID risk, and they ended it. They did it, you know, in a few weeks. And I remember at the time speaking to different homelessness charities, and there was a real sense of energy and excitement that was like, okay, well, this can be done. It's not that expensive. These 5,000 people or whatever across the UK have been housed in hotels. It's happened really, really quickly. And I remember getting a note back from the editor who was working on it, who said, well, kind of questioning that point, and was like, well, you know, can it really be solved? Because it can't just be, surely can't just be a question of political will. I was like, no, I mean, it literally is. I think that's what that showed, is that if you just choose to put money into it, and in the scheme of budgets, it's not actually that much money. So it can be done. And I think that's the really interesting thing here as well. Again, with quite talking about a different end of the problem, obviously, you're talking about much more about the hidden homeless and people at risk of falling into homelessness, which is a huge group. But it's that same thing. It can be done. It is possible. It's not this kind of thing that's just a necessary part of living in a society, that there are things that can be done to substantially reduce the number of people who are homeless.
Jonathan, did that kind of COVID example inform your thinking?
Yeah, I think COVID was an interesting time for us because we had just started out as a charity basically about a year prior to COVID starting. So that was challenging. But yeah, I completely agree. And I was going to quote a good friend of our project, Phil Carey, who's the CEO of New Horizons Youth Centre, which is a youth homelessness charity in London. In a way, I think I would say, if you... You know, we often feel like, okay, maybe, you know, not one single government department can solve homelessness on its own. That's probably true. But I'll put it to you that, you know, one single government department is able to make the problem significantly worse. And we're seeing that happen right now with the Home Office's policy on asylum seekers, right? What we're seeing at the moment is essentially that asylum, people being granted asylum are being decanted out of hotels and onto the streets, essentially. And local authorities are having to try to pick up the pieces on that. So that alone is probably, you know, significantly worsening rough sleeping as a problem across the UK today. So you think, well, you know, you think that it's an intractable problem, but on the other hand, you know, it's very clear in the last 10 to 14 years that we can trace exactly, you know, what some of the things that led to, you know, significant worsening of the problems are, which in a weird way gives me great hope that, you know, the reverse is true, right? Like we can, it is within reach. It is something that we can do as a society, and we absolutely can solve it. So yeah, I think Samira, I completely agree.
After the break, we'll talk more about whether this controversial policy measure is misunderstood. But first, I'd like to tell you about the upgraded digital experience you can enjoy with the New Prospect app. Stay informed and engaged with our independent journalism at your fingertips. read or listen anywhere at any time. The app not only gives you access to our articles, but also includes audio narration, plus podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. Subscribe to Prospect and get instant access to the new app, available on iOS and Android.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at Burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Can we maybe quickly kind of, and I appreciate this could be a never-ending part of the conversation to go into, but what are those things that have led us to this situation? Of course, we know about austerity, but what are the steps, the government, in government policy, the changes that have led to this point, or, you know, in the wider economy? How would you kind of set out that road that got us to this point? What are the stops along the way?
Jonathan's probably better informed about this than I am. You want to go ahead?
Well, I don't know if that's true. So I'll start from our perspective. I think what's very clear, what we need to solve the problem as it is today, are sort of three key pillars would be, you know, affordable housing supply. I think that's very, very clear that we need more affordable housing. I think, interestingly, we were having a debate recently about whether or not more housing in general is a necessary condition, actually, because we do technically have enough dwellings in the UK to house everyone. Anyway, so that's the first pillar, right? Affordable housing. The second pillar would be, you know, more health and social care capacity, you know, and I think that is to do with austerity. A good friend of mine, so I'm very glad I can call him friend, he's a support worker at Aspire. His name is Barry. And when we first met Barry in 2017, his caseload was probably 20-something. So that's sort of how many people he's helping at any one point in time on average. His caseload now, I met him about 6 months ago now, it's about 53, right? Which is ridiculous when you think about that kind, what that actually implies. Because if he gave everyone 1 hour of time a week and you include admin and travel, that's what, like a 75-hour work week for him. And he would only be giving everyone 1 hour of time a week, which is really not enough when you think about people who really need support, you know, and a lot of TLC to help them achieve their goals, right? And get better. And I think the last pillar is financial resilience, which I think, again, has to come, I think in many ways does come back down to austerity, but also just the sort of economic frailty in a way of the UK in general, right? And that's, I think, the pillar that we act on, because basically people don't really have financial resilience anymore. So Samira mentioned what we do in terms of supporting people with rent arrears. I can give you an example of a mother and her three kids in London, whom we supported over COVID, she basically lost her job for 6 months. And she had to make a choice between feeding either her kids or paying her landlord. I think we'll almost all agree that she chose to feed her kids and it was the right thing to do. But that basically meant that she accumulated about $6,000 or $7,000 in rent arrears in a very short period of time, because, you know, rent in London is just like that, right? She had gotten another job again, so the arrears were stable. But what then happened was that she couldn't quite pay off that $7,000 in arrears in a sort of quick enough time period. So eviction was being threatened, essentially. But you think just how, you know, how silly is it as a system overall to allow these four people to go through the homelessness pathway, right? Not only the individual trauma, right? So set that aside, but you think about the amount of admin costs, the temporary accommodation costs. Spending £7,000 to pay off their arrears is a fantastic deal that we should do every single time. But really, I think what we're seeing is that people no longer have the ability to cover themselves, even for 6 months. You know, so what's happening is that that's then pushing people very, very quickly and rapidly into homelessness. There are, I think, lots of other things as well we can talk about, like, you know, no-fault evictions and, you know, right to buy leading to a shortage of social housing supply. But I think in general, we sort of see it across those three pillars, those three main pillars, right? That's how sort of we see our theory of change.
And to that financial resilience point, I'd add, you know, you were asking about the policy steps that have led us here. I think that, you know, the sort of decision in under the austerity policy to basically de-link the amount of money paid in benefits from the amount of money it costs to live, which is effectively what's happened. I mean, I think then it's inevitable that you have people falling through the safety net at a great rate. I think that there's also just a whole bunch, I mean, without getting too much into the weeds about it, a whole series of policies in the way that the benefit system has been redesigned that just make it impossible for people. I did a piece last year about hunger in the UK, and one of the biggest reasons people end up in debt on their universal credit is debts to the DWP, to the Department for Work and Pensions, because of this system where, you know, there's a 5-week delay before you get your first payment. People need to be advanced on it. Then they have to keep paying it back, which means the amount they get every month is much reduced, which means that they don't have money to live or to eat and they have to go to food banks. So, you know, there's all these kinds of bugs built into the system. The fact that, you know, if you're below a certain age, I can't remember the exact age, but I think it's below 25, I'd have to check. But if you're below a certain age, then the amount of money you get in universal credit is actually below the internationally set standard for destitution. So that is built into the system. You know, those safety nets are supposed to be there to help people get back onto their feet. It's all been, in particularly since the coalition government came in, structured around the idea that, you know, make it really, really hard for people and that's going to motivate them to get out of poverty. But that doesn't work. I mean, we can see, in fact, if you make it so low, it doesn't motivate people to get out. It puts people into survival mode. They're desperate. They're thinking about where does my next meal come from, not how can I have a more sustainable future. And I think that's where this idea of money and the impact of money is so important, because actually we have a whole government policy that's sort of set around, you know, let's make you as desperate as we can, and then that's going to motivate you to get out there. And in fact, it's sort of like people are desperate and they don't have any resilience, they don't have any ability to plan. And so I think the idea of what Greater Change is doing and what the research internationally that's being done around the impact of cash transfers is sort of the antithesis to that. And I think that's really interesting. You know, give people money, and that is often what eases the situation. It's not a lack of motivation, it's literally a lack of cash a lot of the time.
Jonathan, obviously what you're doing is in the nonprofit sector, and, you know, helping a huge number of people, and the examples that you've spoken about and that Samira reports out in her piece as well, you know, some of them are really kind of hopeful stories actually about people getting back on their feet. But isn't it a problem that you have to exist at all, and that, you know, NGOs, nonprofits are doing this work when actually, as Samira says, there are these much bigger structural problems, and it's almost a sort of a last chance situation.
Well, it's tough. And I completely agree with the general sentiment, which is that, you know, we couldn't be happier if the government made us redundant tomorrow. You know, if they came in and they said, yeah, we're going to provide this in the exact way that you're going to do it, that you've been doing it. And, you know, yeah, that's the goal. When you look at the number of people experiencing homelessness in the UK, I think latest estimates, you know, Ellen, you were mentioning some of the stats there, but some of the estimates around 300,000 people, right, experiencing various forms of homelessness. We've been talking about the cost of living crisis. You know, I think that's estimated to push, what was it, 1.7 million people on the edge, right, of homelessness. So you think about, you know, that number of people who need this sort of support, that's not something that can be done, you know, using private philanthropy in the UK. And so that's not the goal, right? The goal is to try to pull on some public policy change levers. We want to, and that's a part of why the evidence is so important. That's why the, you know, all the things that Samira has been saying, she's doing a much better job pitching greater change than I am today. But, you know, it's really about saying that if you look at the evidence breaks a lot of that stereotypical narrative. And that's why it's so important to pursue the evidence, right? So it's not evidence for evidence's sake. It's for the sake of informing better public policy. So yeah, I definitely agree that I think, you know, at the end of the day, public policy change is the only lever you can pull on that will be able to allow us to help, you know, all the people who need it in the UK, essentially. And that actually, you know, that's why it's so important to look at the nuanced case studies, to not just think about homelessness as, you know, rough sleeping. I think, you know, it's a very stereotyped issue in the UK, homelessness. And that's why it's so important to break that. And that's why it's so important to also look at everything that we're able to achieve when we give people the dignity of choice. And basically saying that, hey, actually, you know, believe it or not, when you let people make decisions about their own lives and it's their lives on the line, literally, you know, they tend to make pretty good decisions, actually, and it tends to be pretty successful and it's great for everyone. You know, so I just say I couldn't agree more with the sentiment. But I think as a starting point, you know, this is where we have to begin, and we're working ourselves out of the job.
I mean, I think that point about the dignity of giving people choice is actually really interesting and something that kind of came through, I think, in those case studies, those interviews that you did, Samira. I mean, how important do you think that dignity is versus the actual value of the cash itself in kind of helping people move on and achieve their goals and, you know, get to the place that they want to be?
I think that's really important. And that is something that, well, we haven't actually talked about it today, but there was a big study recently done last year in Canada. The results came out around the impact of giving cash to homeless people. That's something they mentioned as well, this idea that just because you're poor, it doesn't mean you're stupid. You're probably the best place to know what it is that you need. And yeah, I think the idea of dignity is really, really important, because that's something that, you know, I've noticed that reporting this piece and reporting other pieces around poverty, that people feel their dignity is stripped away. People don't like having to ask for help. People don't like describing themselves as homeless. People don't like admitting that they need that help. And so I think a lot of the kind of paternalistic approaches that are quite routine can be experienced by people as a further degradation. And I think something about saying this is what I need and being able to make that choice, I think, is really powerful. And that's borne out as well in some of the international studies that I talk about in the piece, that, you know, some of the earliest studies on this approach really were just direct cash transfers. I mean, there are no conditions attached, no training, no support in how to spend it, nothing else. And just that support, these amounts of like $500 or whatever, actually really still had a massive impact on helping people out of their situations and an effect that lasted. So yeah, I think that's really, really important, and probably something that we don't talk about, you know, enough, not just in terms of homelessness, but generally in terms of the massive rise in poverty that we're seeing. It's horrible. It's degrading. It's, you know, it's experienced by lots of people as a loss of dignity.
I think what we often say is when you give people something nice, they take care of it, because they got to choose the furnishing in the flat. You know, they get to pick the color of the couch. They get to go and actually get something firsthand, and, you know, instead of going to a secondhand shop. It just means that they just have that much more buy-in, right, into the plan. It's something that they own in every sense of the word. And that gives them something to really look forward to really protect and say, hey, this is a milestone step for me. So yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's a massive, massive part. And it's not just the fact that you make better decisions being on the front line and you make better decisions because it's your life. It's also the fact that you can then really own it and you really feel proud of it. I think that's really important.
Before we go, I want to also just talk about another kind of big radical policy idea that is much discussed, but I guess hasn't really got mainstream support in the UK, at least, which is that idea of universal basic income, which has some similarities to what you're talking about, but obviously a much wider application. I mean, I'm interested to hear from both Samira and Jonathan what you think the differences are, the similarities between this direct cash transfer approach and UBI.
Yeah, I think there's definitely similarities. I mean, when I was reading about it, there's a much viewed TED talk by Rutger Bregman, who's the Dutch writer and thinker who talks a lot about universal basic income and also about the power of basically giving people money. And so there's a real kind of overlap, I think, between those ideas. I guess the difference here is it's about specifically giving money to ease those blockages that might be getting someone into a really difficult situation, getting someone into homelessness. And so it's really about a kind of crisis response, I guess, or someone who's already at a very low ebb, whereas universal basic income, obviously, by its nature, is universal. But I think there's definite similarities there in the thinking. I'd be interested to know what Jonathan thinks, but it's sort of the idea that give the resources first and let people decide.
I totally agree. I think it's the same family of ideas, because you think about, again, the individual dignity of choice. You think about the fact that, again, you know, cash is useful, right? I mean, it's not a bad thing to give people flexibility. You know, so certainly, I think philosophically, it's very well aligned in that sense. Actually, recently, we had we gave a talk with the UBI lab folks at Manchester, as well as Mark Donovan, who's the CEO of the Denver Basic Income Project. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but basically they are trying UBI in bits of Denver, essentially in the US. And yeah, I think it's a very naturally aligned thing. I think, as Samira is suggesting, it's probably a wider set of actual policies compared to what we are talking about. We're talking about, you know, I think something that what Greater Change is doing in terms of providing personalized budgets, I think actually is really not that far away from existing UK social care policy. It's just that next step, really. Because, you know, in theory, you should be able to access what are called discretionary housing payments from your local authority. So that's to say that if you're experiencing homelessness and they've accepted their care duties to you, in theory, if you're looking for a place to live and you need a rent deposit, in theory, you can apply to your council for support for rent deposits. In practice, that doesn't usually work out, sadly. But, you know, there are some councils out there that are using some really innovative methods, being your rent guarantor, things like that. You know, so there are some really interesting policies out there. So as I said, I think personalized budgets not that far away, actually, from what we're already doing. And I think UBI would be a step further because it would be a much broader range of coverage. But no, I think it, philosophically, it's something that personally I think is very well aligned with what we do. Yeah.
Just before we go, it'd be great to hear from both of you about how optimistic you are about those connections being made between what the nonprofit sector is doing and what policymakers in government are thinking about, talking about. You know, what's the look ahead?
I'm sadly not that optimistic about that. As we've been talking about, it just sort of, I think part of the reason this feels so radical is because it's so far in the opposite direction of how policy has been made and designed over the last, particularly since 2010. I don't know how much of a change we'll see if the government changes. It's really difficult to say. And I think certainly the language from both main political parties continues to be around you know, not being soft on benefits claimants, et cetera, et cetera. And so I feel that given that, yeah, I'm not super optimistic. And also I think, you know, something that Jonathan mentioned that we haven't got into too much is that while I think this seems to be the evidence that this is an extremely effective approach, there obviously are these massive structural problems. We don't have enough affordable housing. Council housing has effectively been replaced with temporary accommodation because, you know, there aren't council houses to move people into. So far, I don't see any kind of serious discussion about solving those structural problems. And yeah, the whole kind of language around poverty, I think, continues in the sort of vein that I detail in the piece. And that makes it difficult to be optimistic. But who knows, I'd be really happy to be proved wrong.
I think what makes me really optimistic are two things. I think the conversation around personalized budgets is changing now. I can sort of feel it when, you know, compared to sort of 7 years ago when we first started Greater Change in 2017, every single conversation I had basically would be with someone who would say, well, what if people spent the money on drugs? What if blah, 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 blah happened, you know, and all these sort of disastrous things. And I think it could be that I'm keeping better company now, but I feel like we are getting, you know, more traction with people that we're speaking to. And excellent pieces of coverage like this, like Samira's article, helps that. I think the other thing is that I do think the Strivers and Skivers narrative is losing its grip on UK culture. I don't know if it's because people are just so much closer to the reality of the fact that, you know, actually half of us are basically at risk nowadays, that maybe that's forced a rethinking of that narrative. But I think also the other positive thing is that I wonder if actually we're now at a point where things are so bad when it comes to local authority finances, when it comes to government finances, that they really don't have a choice but to look very practically at evidence-driven ways to end the crisis, because it is going to destroy local government as we know it, you know, and that's the reality that I think policymakers will have to face. And so I wonder if maybe the crisis is going to breed and force their hand on innovation and on practical policies to finally end homelessness. Because as you said, Samira, I think you're completely right. I think that's the thing that makes me so optimistic. It's so achievable. It's so achievable. It's just a matter of will. And I wonder if the crisis is going to drive the will. So that's my hope and the optimist in me.
We'll certainly be hoping that is indeed the case, and that this what seems like a relatively simple fix can indeed help more people. So thank you very much, Samira and Jonathan, for coming on the podcast, sharing your thoughts, analysis, expertise. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. That's all for now. Thanks so much to Samira and Jonathan for joining us. And thanks to our listeners at home for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, then head to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk, where you can read Samira's excellent feature, plus former UK ambassador to the US Kim Darroch on the possibility of Trump 2.0, Sheila Hancock and Alice Garnett in an intergenerational conversation, and much, much more. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.